Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio overlooking beautiful Luray Bay and bringing you in the news the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and is usual. But in the battle of Western civilization, reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to will bring. Kinds of the views that are expressed here are not necessary. Owners, management, staff, sponsor, station you're listening to, they happen to be the views of our guests. And today we have with us Dr. Sally Baliunas. And Dr. Baliunas has done a great deal of work on weather, on global warming. She works at the Wilson Observatory. She works certainly back at MIT. And we're very, very glad to have her with us today. Thank you very much for being with us, Sally.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Why don't you tell us, just our listeners out there who don't know who you are, just a little bit about yourself, your background, and what it was that drew you to begin to study this whole subject of global warming.
Well, I've been looking at the changes in the sun over time, and that means eons, billions of years, and how they affect the life and the environment of the Earth. And about 15 years ago, became an interesting topic to look at more recent past histories, that is, in the last 100 years, the last 1,000 years, the last million years, how the sun might have changed, how it might have affected our environment.
All right, fine. And, of course, how would then you know what had happened 1,000 years ago or 2,000 or 3,000 years ago?
Well, you can look at, you can very simply do some reading. We have some records, people who have kept records or made comments about unusual weather events, a storm, or might have been just keeping inventory of what plants that were growing, say in China 1,000 years ago, how the crops were growing, weather. When's the time the last whales froze, when the plum blossoms budded on the trees. So we have some evidence like that. But we also have very important hard physical evidence, changes in the environment that get recorded by the environment, and then one can go, scientists go analyze those changes. For example, ice cores drilled out of the ice cap in Greenland or Antarctica, and layer by layer build up the past histories of what's gone on there for as far back several million years. And scientists have analyzed some of them 800,000 years for the case of Antarctica.
Well, now, of course, we're told that we have global warming today. Do we really have global warming today?
Well, we have warming and cooling. We have most of the Earth today is warmer than it was, say, on average in the 19th century. And it's warmer by maybe a degree Fahrenheit. On a scale of things going back in time, depending how far back you go, that 1 degree Fahrenheit is not that meaningful. That is, it's been warmer in the past, it's been a lot colder in the past.
Well, of course, now we hear a lot about how the Arctic ice cap is melting. We hear about how the glaciers are melting, and this is all being used to justify this idea that mankind is destroying the world by his actions. Is it true that the Arctic ice cap is melting and that the glaciers are melting?
Well, we have to separate some ideas here and be quite clear. There has been some warming. The 20th century was warmer on average than the 19th. But now the question for scientists is to dig in and ask, well, what's the cause of that warming? Now, as a result of the warming, the Earth's ecosystems have responded. For example, some glaciers have pulled back. Other glaciers have grown. Advancing and retreating glaciers, that's a very complex problem and depends on local conditions sometimes. It's not true that all glaciers are retreating.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
And our guest this afternoon has been with MIT and Institute. And so she knows a great deal of all of these things. The authority on this of warming in the last century. A lot of that actually to the large amounts of CO2 in the air, but there is an organized effort to convince the American, a terrible special legislation, the protocol, which will have a devastating effect on, and yet it doesn't in any way restrict greenhouse other countries. It primarily targeted the United States. Is this whole idea of global warming, is this valid being used for political purposes?
Well, in terms of carbon dioxide, humans have increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, and we have done it mostly in the last 50 years. You said something very pertinent at the beginning of your paragraph, which is that the temperature of the 20th century didn't zoom up all at once in step with the increase in the air's carbon dioxide content. The temperature warmed early in the 20th century, flat or even cooled a bit at the end of the 20th, quite matched the pattern of growth in the air CO2 20th century. The effect of adding the carbon dioxide hasn't been very large. It hasn't been the whole 1 degree Fahrenheit. Of course, what happened earlier in the 20th century is largely unrelated to it. Now there's the issue of what should we be so concerned about it that one should immediately adopt the Kyoto Protocol. The problem with the Kyoto Protocol is it really doesn't do any good if one is very concerned about the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. And you pointed out the problem. It just doesn't make meaningful cuts worldwide. It asks the United States to make cuts. It asks countries in Europe, other developed nations to make cuts. But the big emitters coming online, China, India, as you mentioned, don't make any cuts. So it really has no meaning in terms of addressing what is pointed to be the problem that it's meant to address. So
hold that thought right there for just a moment, please.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Sally Valiunas, and she certainly works in this field as far as atmosphere is concerned. She's done a great deal of research and study on this, pointing out that many times in past centuries and millennia, it's been much hotter than it is today, and many times it's been much colder than it is today. In fact, Greenland is called Greenland because at one time, why they grew grapes there. It was a green, fertile country, and but then at that time it was much hotter, and the atmosphere was much hotter, and that was about 1,500 years ago?
About 1,000 years ago, there are areas of the world where it was at least as warm as today, if not a little warmer, and there's certainly, that had to have natural causes. So part of the question scientists have to resolve is, well, what are the natural factors that affect climate? What does the sun do? What does the oceans do? What does the atmosphere do? What do volcanoes do? And try to add those all in, then try to say, well, what are all the human effects? That means not just carbon dioxide, but perhaps modifying local landscape, making, changing an area from forest to farmland. And all those things are very uncertain. Don't have a reliable way of determining those.
All right, fine. Well, does the increased CO2 in the atmosphere, we refer to it as one of the greenhouse gases, is the CO2 a major factor in global warming?
That's the big question. There has been a rise in CO2. There's been a small warming trend, one at the end of the 20th century, that rises in step with the rise in CO2 content. But it hasn't been huge. It's only been a few tenths of a degree. So the question is, how huge could it be? What will it look like 100 years from now? And those questions really are unanswerable.
Well, of course, we hear, of course, that everything is moving in crisis, that certainly we are going to destroy the Earth, a man is going to bring about tremendous storms, and, of course, they always attribute them to global warming. Whenever it's cold, they attribute that to global warming, too. Tremendous, freezing atmosphere in many parts of the country. The cold is, I can't quite understand, politically.
We're bombarded with that's nonsense. There are huge floods. It's not so unusual.
And what about the storms we hear so much about, the Katrina and Rita and Wilma and all of these things? Have we had storms of this intent?
Oh, yes, there have been storms of this intent. High hurricane season. Hurricanes tend to appear in the 1990s. Expected as cyclones. been interested in the destruction, but that's really the problem where we live. We choose to live, we choose to build expensive property, and those get knocked down by hurricanes. So the insurance losses have gone up.
I mean, look and see what's happening as far as the climate change is concerned. It would appear to be that at least the Kyoto Protocol, TARP as you mentioned, but not the wood, dramatic changes, cutting back on our living standards, restricting our access to the, to energy, certainly closing down our generating plants, getting people out of their cars. Would this stop the global warming change that is taking place? Or is that happen to do more with the sun and its influence rather than on the amount of CO2 in the environment?
Well, certainly the amount of cuts that the Kyoto Treaty asks the developed world to make are minuscule in terms. They don't really reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere decades into the future. So if one believes that carbon dioxide increases that have already occurred are driving worse climate, then Kyoto doesn't solve anything. What really would need to happen, should one focus on that, is to shut down coal plants, for example, which provide 55% of the United States electricity. You'd have to greatly reduce the use of gasoline, fossil fuels, and even reduce natural gas. You'd have to replace a lot of that with nuclear power. I'm not advocating one way or another, I'm just mentioning the scope of the problem. So there would have to be thousands of nuclear power plants built, for example, if one really wanted to cut the amount of carbon dioxide emitted and make a meaningful change in the atmosphere's carbon dioxide content. I think discussions have to focus on, from a scientific point of view, what is the magnitude of the problem? No one knows. No one can make an accurate assessment of what climate and weather will be 100 years from now. Goodness, we can't make it, you know, we can't really talk about weather, certainly in New England, a week ahead of time with any reliability.
Well, of course, we're told that the United Nations and the scientists have decided that there really is a very strong relationship between global warming and man's activity, specifically the increase in the CO2 in the environment. And time and time again, we will read in the newspaper, this question is scientifically decided by the scientific community. Is that really true?
No, scientists are pretty much very cautious about what they can predict, and most scientists would say, no, we cannot predict this into the future. I think most scientists would say, we have concern, but we can't tell what. Now, if asked by government, some official authorities, 100 years from now, of course, scientists will often in the media that should follow those forming along with them. Most scientists agree. If somebody might disagree about that, that would be the wrong question because we on something like this.
Well, you know, I read the New York Times on a regular basis. You know, they simply take this one position. There is no question at all that this is the fact that certainly the answer has been given by the scientists, and that really wouldn't be.
No, scientists largely agree, and not all of them, but scientists largely agree that in the 20th century compared to the 19th century was unusually cold, longer average. But there's been warming in the 20th century. Scientists also largely agree that the amount of carbon dioxide has increased in the air. They largely agree that human activities have contributed to that. And they probably largely agree that all things being equal, there should be some warming effect to that increase in carbon dioxide. But they certainly don't agree on what the amount of that impact would be and what would happen in the future. And to shut down the debate, which is what that does, the language of saying scientists all agree essentially shuts down the debate and says we don't want to hear from science anymore. But only science is going to give you an accurate answer.
All right. Now, what percentage of the greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide? Now, my understanding is that the majority of the greenhouse gases are actually water vapor.
Most of the greenhouse effect that warms the earth, that keeps the earth warmer than greenhouse crystals and water, Now, humans are largely of the water vapor effect, but there may be a leverage, some of the leverage the change in carbon dioxide to make greater vapor. And so that's still debated. A small leverage into a big one.
In other words, you're changing more evaporation in the atmosphere, and that in its act as an increase in warming?
That's a whole path.
Is that an accurate appraisal?
I don't. I know that others do.
Now, what about the impact on the atmosphere? The sun creates global warming. Does the sun influence the Earth?
Well, let's talk about the sun, because that is an interesting interject. It is the source of a lot of the energy. If the sun were constant, have to worry about its influence, but the sun changes. And this is, say, in a few this past decade or so. There are sunspots, as you mentioned. Those are dark areas of the sun. They are made of intense magnetic fields shaped in loop structures that jut out above the surface back down towards. And early telescope observers like Galileo and his computer.
Hold that. Well, Dr. Stan, Ali Baliunas, we're talking about the sun on the temperature here on Earth. We were talking about sunspots and adapting the Galileo.
It's just 100 years ago. And so there's a record telescopes going back. Scientists have studied this. They've discovered the surface of the sun, which really means the amount of strong magnetic field, increases and decreases with a period of roughly 11 years. So you may have heard the phrase the 11-year sunspot cycle, the 11-year cycle or the sunspot cycle. Now, it's not just 5 years. It can be 8 years, each cycle to the next. It can be long. It can be 12 to 15, rare. And the cycle, hard to detect it with the very to the world of the last 1,000 years. It was no coincidence that the sun had to this very cold at a longer 500-year period called the Little Ice Age, the Earth experience of the year. But there's a great deterioration of climate, storminess, severe storminess, in particular types of hail those years. The harvest would be very poor. People suffer from starvation and disease. So looking back at the go for 400 years, there's pretty good correlation between temperature and temperature the amount of radiation coming from this. Then you can go back further in time by looking at the amount of radiocarbon, carbon-14 that is, in tree rings. You can go back on 10,000 years and see ups and downs in the sun's energy output, and those often correlate with ups and downs in temperature of the Earth. So there's an interesting derivative of changes in the sun linked to changes in the Earth. Now, the sun is not going to be changes the climate of the Earth, but the changes line up pretty well. Now, how much does the sun change? Well, we don't really know. How much does the sun change? How much in comparison to, say, oxide change, escape, or all things? It's too confusing a picture to really work that out yet.
Well, of course, apparently the 1600s, you're referring to the 17th century, that would be the 1600s. The 1600s were really a time when the Earth was very, very cold. Has it been more or less warming since then?
It's been warming, not continuously since then. So in the past 4 months, it's warming.
Please. Here at Radio Liberty, our guest today is Dr. Baliunas, and she's at MIT in California. And so talking to some other intense cooling, and they actually have records from time. And certainly, then, of course, there's been a gradual, although Earth's temperature 1600s, and of course, taking us now 400. So it is really
very well. You know, it's been staggered that there've been moves in there, but on the whole, a rise over across those 4 centuries.
So the increase in carbon dioxide or levels begin rising. In fact, was most of the warming that we see in the world today before the increase of the level of the CO2?
Well, for the 20th century, you'd say half, if not a little fraction more than that, or maybe a little less, depending on whose temperature measurements you're looking at before 1950, say. Very strong warm at the end of the 19th century, too, about that really predate air with carbon dioxide use. A hard question, because there are been invented to say a degree Fahrenheit, of course, means different things. It was would have been substantially warmer at the high latitudes, so in Greenland, for example, and around the low latitude regions, it might not have changed as much.
All we know is we find evidence of warming, but nothing then over this 400 years. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, and you have to look at the impacts. I'm looking at global temperature because those measurements don't really exist. You measure the temperature in an area, the ecosystem responds locally, and so I like looking at local measures.
And, of course, we hear a lot about the temperature measurements that are taken by satellite. Are these, of course, here they're trying to get some sort of an average around the world. Are these things really useful, and do they differ from temperature measurements on the ground today?
Good question. The satellite measurements are made as the satellite swings across the surface of the Earth every day. It sees most of the Earth at least once during a day, and so you are sampling much more than you do with the ground-based thermometers. You are sampling a region of the air from above the surface to a few miles, and that's a very important region because that layer of air is extremely sensitive to the effect of the buildup of carbon dioxide in the air, and it should be warming faster than the surface. Now, this has become a scientific an enormous scientific puzzle, and puzzle understates the word. That layer of air is not warming faster than the surface, and so it either means that the surface measurements are contaminated with other effects other than the added greenhouse gases in the air. The satellite measurements are completely wrong, or the models of the physics is completely wrong. So it says there's room for humility here.
Well, of course, it doesn't for instance, where they take the measurement on the Earth vary. For instance, cities, because they certainly have so much asphalt in them, you know, would be entirely different than you might find out in the forest someplace as far as measuring temperature.
Absolutely. And looking back over time, you know, a thermometer might be set up in the city. For example, the end of the 19th century in the United States, so a lot of thermometers set up, and those areas look very different. Some thermometers have moved, and some have the cities changed around them.
So basically, the measurement of Earth temperature is not as accurate as some people might like us to believe.
I don't think it's accurate. I don't think it's accurate. It's what we have to work with, and scientists have done the best they can, but there's uncertainty.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment or two. And do you mind taking any questions from our audience if they have questions for you?
That would be fine.
All right, fine. When we get back, we'll invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, 464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Baliunas, and Dr. Baliunas is certainly a scientist who deals with atmosphere. We're talking about this whole concept of global warming being used to justify the Kyoto Protocol, which would have a profound impact on the economy, on the lives of the average American. The average person really doesn't understand the dramatic changes in our way of life that the Kyoto Protocol would bring if it were to be ratified here in the United States. Do you have any thoughts at all on the Kyoto Protocol as far as it's, you mentioned earlier that you didn't really feel that it would do that much good to actually lower the global warming throughout the world. But what about its implications as far as our country is concerned?
Well, there are studies, and here I'm not the expert, but I'm relying on people from Yale and others, and there is good agreement. Energy is a critical part of the economy of the world, and cutting fossil fuel use means cutting energy use unless you're going to substitute with a non-fossil fuel, non-carbon dioxide emitting fuel. Now, there have been suggestions that, well, you can make that up with conservation. Well, you really can't, not if you want economic growth, or that you could make up those cuts in energy use with alternate energy resources like wind turbines or wave power or solar energy. And you really can't, because those forms of energy, those sources as electricity, are not quality electricity. They're not reliable. They're not there all the time when you need them. You can't count on them. And they're very dilute. So, in fact, they take up a lot of landscape, either wind turbines or panels. So there's no way around this except that you have energy prices rise, and they rise substantially. So what are you getting for that rise in energy price? And the answer is not much reduction in CO2, not any reduction in the air's future CO2. So that's what the debate comes down to. And estimates by economics experts have been something like for the U.S. to abide by the Kyoto Treaty, they were estimating a few years ago something like, $2 trillion over 10 years, over a 10-year period.
The impact, financial impact on the United States would be...
What it would cost the U.S. economy to abide by this treaty, $2 trillion. Now, you can argue with those numbers a little bit, but it's a large number.
And I really think it really is. I think that people have no idea what they're really talking about. We'll be back in just a moment here with Dr. Ballina. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and Dr. Ballina and I were talking about the impact of the Kyoto Protocol if it were to be enacted. The average individual thinks these things are really not going to affect them. Life is going to go on as it always has, and I would like to suggest that this is really not true. There really are people who would like to impose the Kyoto Protocol. They believe that man has created terrible problems on the Earth, and Dr. Palinas was suggesting that over a 10-year period, this could cost our economy about $2 trillion. That's T like tomboy, $2 trillion. Like Al Gore had talked about, the fact that we were going to have to face a wretching transformation of society. A wretching transformation of society, and you were to take $2 trillion out of our economy over a period of 10 years to abide by the Kyoto Protocol, you would begin really to impoverish the American people. Would that be a very pretty valid estimation?
I think so, and I would add to that Kyoto Treaty cuts need to be followed by 30 times that amount, to level off the amount of CO2 in the air, the air's concentration of CO2, by, say, the year 2050. You'd really have to make those cuts 20, 30, or 40 times is the estimate. And these numbers have been well known ever since they've been well known for 10 years as we've been discussing this Kyoto Treaty for 10 years almost.
So basically, we would really be talking about a dramatic change in our way of life here in the United States. And I really think that there are people who would like to see a dramatic change in our way of life and lowering the living standards of the average American, as I always like to say, raising their living standards to that of the Bolivian peasant. These people say that's crazy talk, and I would say, well, we're not necessarily dealing with rational people. We're people who have a different worldview. And if they want to advocate that, that's fine. But I think they ought to be honest, and they ought to say that, there is a great deal of really disagreement among scientists as to what part the global warming is actually being produced by man's activity. No question that we've increased the amount of CO2, but doesn't actually increasing the CO2 in the environment help with the growth of trees and plants, and isn't it really beneficial for agriculture?
Well, it is. CO2 is plant food. There's no doubt about it. And what that adds into all the different changes that occur, that's a question that cannot be calculated with any degree of reliability at present. So we just don't know. some people have argued, well, since we don't know and this is potentially catastrophic, let's just err on the side of precaution. And I don't mind having that debate. I think that's an honest thing to do, is to ask that question. And then you say, all right, then let's, just for the sake of marching through this thought, let's say we have to drop CO2 emissions enormously, then what does that mean? It means saying that the Kyoto Treaty isn't meaningful in terms of the cuts, and that 20, 30, or 40 times the cuts have to be made, and then looking really at those, at those changes. So I'd like to have the whole picture discussed.
But of course, nobody really wants to do, really get into that and look at this thing objectively. Right, once again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But right now, let's go to Ralph, who's calling us from Oklahoma. Ralph, did you have a question for our guest?
Okay, you may know this gentleman, J.R. Moore, which he is a close friend, I think, of Craig Roberts.
All right.
Okay, anyway, he's got a spot, on Saturday on another shortwave deal, and he's been talking about, he's got all the data to support it, so all you got to do is check and see that they're doing it. It's a constant battle keeping the Alaskan pipeline jacked up, excuse me, and the permafrost is thawing out. And I just wondered, I may have missed it when I was in the process of calling. Maybe your guest mentioned something about that.
All right, fine. You're suggesting that the permafrost is dry.
He's got all the data to support it. So the contract companies see how many of them are working on it. And he doesn't allude to global warming or anything like that. He just brings up that one fact.
All right, fine. Dr. Balienas, do you know anything about the permafrost thawing up?
A little bit. Alaska, for example, the temperatures have warmed, and some areas of Alaska, the permafrost has pulled back in some areas. That is true. But when you look at the temperature of Alaska, what's happened is that it's very linked to changes in the Pacific Ocean. And the Pacific Ocean has undergone changes that no one can associate with the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, because the changes are quite sudden. They undergo what's called an oscillation. It's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or PDO. This is a interesting recent discovery, that the Pacific Ocean sits in one condition across different areas for some 20 or 30 years, and then fairly quickly changes to a different, it oscillates to a different state. No, that's been going on for hundreds of years, records and information can tell us. But what happens is, this 1976, this change occurred, that resulted in the warming of Alaska very dramatically. So the temperature records of Nome, if you look at them, Nome is cool through the 1950s and 60s, and all of a sudden 1976 jumps up. Now, most of the temperature of Alaska did jump up, averaged across the station, 1976-77, but on average they've been going down a little bit. But if you draw a straight line to that, you see a trend, but it's not really a smooth trend. It's this step up and step down that's been going on for some time. So it looks like that's a natural. And, of course, the environment of Alaska responds to it. Now, in Siberia and Russia, I know there have been reports that the permafrost there has been deteriorating, but the Russians have come out and said, no, it's not. And they have shown their data to say that it's not.
I saw there's a lot of confusion there, Rob. Anyway, anything else you'd like to say?
No, that was it. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Yeah. And certainly there are a lot of unknowns out there. And certainly we know what Greenland was 1,000 years ago. It was a flush green land. So certainly it was much warmer at that time than it is today. And I suspect that Alaska was a lot warmer about 1,000 years ago than it was today. Do we have any knowledge of what it was like in Alaska 1,000 years ago, like we have with the what it was in Greenland?
Yeah, parts of Alaska were warmer 1,000 years ago, very roughly speaking, than they are today. And the Arctic region undergoes very dramatic changes. Parts of British Columbia were warmer 1,000 years ago than today. And the changes in the Arctic tend to be much more dramatic than they are. So the question is, what are the changes? And how much are recent changes compared to that? And the answer is, they really aren't that dramatic compared to, say, a scale of 1,000 or 2,000 years. And then what are the causes of those changes? So if you see a very sharp jump, and like this Pacific decadal oscillation, to say, well, that's something about the Pacific Ocean that we have to stop and learn. And since that's been going on for some while, you can't attribute that to the air's increased carbon dioxide.
So basically, there wasn't a lot of carbon dioxide necessarily around 1,000 years ago, and yet things were much hotter. So carbon dioxide was not what was giving us a green Greenland or a much warmer Alaska. And so is there any justification for associating the rising CO2 with the slight rise in the temperature? In other words, is this a valid comparison, or can you have things occur together that are not necessarily associated?
Oh, you can have phony correlations, bogus correlations all the time, and that's why science always starts with a correlation but then asks what's the cause of it. You can have the number of pairs. I've seen a very interesting correlation, the birth rate in Germany and the number of pairs of breeding pairs of storks. Does that mean storks bring babies? No. There's just those two numbers just happen to be correlated over some years, some other reasons. So you have to really stop and look at everything. The climate is incredibly complex. Weather is incredibly complex, and we don't understand all the causes of natural climate. We're just beginning to understand that humans have a lot of impact on local regional ecosystems. And to try to put that all together in some holistic or large-scale model is a scientist try it, but it's not as accurate as it needs to be.
Well, have you ever looked into the HARP program that they have up in Alaska, the high, I think it's a high altitude, a rural research project, something like that? I can't.
You know, I have heard of HARP, and I keep meaning to get some information on it because I do get some questions on it, but I apologize.
Well, of course, you don't have to apologize. I just thought you might know something about it, because some people think that this could have an effect on the atmosphere as you beam a billion watts of electricity up into the ionosphere. Well, maybe one of these days you'll have some information you can let us know, because all the things that are happening today, and we always have questions, could there be any possible human interference in the normal weather patterns, or is this simply an act of God? Of course, we probably even shouldn't say that in these days and age. But
well, humans have certainly changed local weather patterns, right? As you pointed out, in cities are different. Some cities have changed their precipitation as soot went in the air. The great fogs of London and some of the rain patterns were changed when coal was burnt in such great quantity hundreds of years ago. When you read about Charles Dickens and look at the horrible fog situation, really smog, the number of deaths, then there have been local influences. Whether or not these local influences translate into something meaningful globally is a question for science.
Well, of course, you're speaking now of the influence of the heat island, where a city will act as a heat island simply because they just can't, the ground can't absorb the heat because there's all the asphalt and the cement there. And so this has been something that's been recognized for some time, hasn't it?
Yes. And then how do you correct the measurements for that known urban heat island effect? Well, scientists do the best they can, but you might not have the best way to make the corrections. What you really need is a thermometer that's been undisturbed for 100 years in the nearby area that hasn't always been available.
And then, of course, the situation in the individual city can actually change over a period of time. So there are lots of imponderables about the whole situation. Well, now, do you spend a lot of your time analyzing weather and weather changes?
I do. I've been interested recently in historical weather changes and how people have tried to explain them, say, by acts of Satan or acts of God. And during this little ice age, there's a very interesting period, the 17th century, you know, the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, the 16th and 17th century. There's certainly political struggles in Europe, but one reason for the bad storms that were coming into Europe and destroying crops, causing starvation, causing disease and death, one reason that people believed in and actually acted on was that the devil could make a deal with people and cause storms. So this idea of cooking the weather, brewing a storm by way of witches. So some of the towns in Europe would, after severe storm, round up a bunch of people that it thought had done this and do away with these people, that is, legally execute them.
In other words, the idea of brewing a storm really came from the witches, the idea that the witches were actually creating the storm.
Yes, that witches, that's right, acting in concert with the devil, and the wisdom was that you had to, that God would be mad if you let those people continue to make those deals with the devil, and so you had better get rid of those people.
I see. Well, of course, this is what I suppose the 1600s, 1700s, somewhere there.
The worst period of mass trials and executions in Europe for witchcraft were between 1550 and 1700. And this coincides also with the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, so political struggle. So not all these trials were about bad weather, but certainly there's a component where bad weather came by and documented in the trials that bad weather, that dropped hail, that killed the crops for that year, were caused by certain people, and they were put on trial, tortured to get confessions, and then executed.
Well, that's certainly a rather tragic situation to realize the history of so much of what's gone on in the past. But the other question is there anything that man really can do to alter the atmosphere? Certainly some people think that there are means available by certain electronic means of altering. Is there any truth to that in your estimation?
Oh, yes. We've altered the atmosphere in terms of putting locally. That is, we've altered patterns by putting soot in the air, so we've altered the amount of sunlight reaching some areas very locally, dimmed some areas. There's some soot called black carbon, very fine carbon particles, black particles. Those may actually be sources of heating. So some scientists at NASA Goddard Institute in New York are proposing that those are causing some heating, so it would diminish the role of carbon dioxide as a heating agent if you added these in, but that they think that cleaning up the soot would not only be helpful but cost-effective and drop the temperature more than if you worked on carbon dioxide. So there are possibilities like that. But yeah, we have added a lot of stuff to the atmosphere. Whether or not it's been a meaningful effect is a scientific question. Whether or not we should do it maybe is a different area. Philosophical or ethical question.
You know, by adding the things to the atmosphere, what are you specifically speaking of? Are you speaking of the things?
Carbon dioxide, methane, soot particles, local pollutants, round-level ozone. There's many things.
Well, I remember hearing something. We were driving through the Central Valley of California and hearing on the radio that one of the major causes of global warming was methane, and of course it was coming from the intestines, the cows, and we were going to have to do something about that. Does human, or at least animal-produced methane, have a significant influence on anything, or is this a real problem?
Well, that's a good question. Methane, there's less methane going in the air from human activities than there is carbon dioxide, but methane is a more potent agent of greenhouse effect than carbon dioxide is. But methane, you'll read this week in the scientific literature that plants have produced a lot of methane in a surprising bit of new science on plants.
My goodness, we're going to have to do away with animals and plants. I don't know how we're going to survive. But anyway, we're out of time. Hey, Dr. Baliunas has been our guest today. Thank you so very much for being with us, and I always appreciate having you.
Thank you, Dr. Stanton.
Bye-bye, and God bless you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we hear a lot about global warming and the danger of global warming. And if you watch the media very, very carefully, you will never hear the other side that says scientists really don't know whether this is having a profound impact on the world or not. And there are a lot of imponderables. But if you read the New York Times, and you read the Washington Post, and you read the Wall Street Journal, and you read Time Magazine, and Newsweek Magazine, and U.S. News and World Report, and so many of the other publications that are popularly circulated, you will get the impression that this issue is totally solved, and that the United Nations, the scientists affiliated with the United Nations agree, and the truth of the matter is, none of this is really so. And the reason it isn't so is because certainly our good friend Art Robinson sent out a circular to, I think it was 18 or 20,000 scientists who would really work in the atmosphere. And there were over 17,000 who returned the questionnaire and agreed that there is no definite proof that man's activity has influenced the atmosphere throughout the world. In other words, this so-called global warming that we have, and as Dr. Baliunas has said, during the last century, why we were dealing with maybe a half degree of warming, maybe three quarters of a degree, but most of it occurred before 1940 when the marked increase in CO2 in the atmosphere came about. But if you really understand what Kyoto was really about, you will find it is really about destroying the economy of this country. There are people who really do believe that we should redistribute our wealth to other nations, and what Kyoto is really about is the wretching transformation of society. That's a term that Al Gore used in his book Earth in the Balance. And as a byproduct of this wretching transformation of society, we would lower the living standards of the average American. Now, this is not going to be the living standards of the Maurice Strongs and the Stephen Rockefellers and the Al Gores and the Bill Clintons and the wealthy elite. What they really want to do is actually destroy the economy of our nation, create a two-tiered system with the feudal masters and, of course, the feudal serfs. What socialism is really all about, and the major driving force behind Kyoto is socialism. Socialism is the restructuring of our society. And until the American people understand there's an agenda behind what's going on, and it is really aimed at the equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations, not the equitable distribution of the wealthy, the equitable distribution of the savings, the life savings of the average American citizen. We'll be right back here to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly this is the time when I want to remind our listeners of Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We are dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours a day across America by radio, by shortwave, by internet, by satellite. And of course, you can hear us 5 hours a day on the radio someplace and 5 hours a day on the internet on the AmericanNewsNet.com, on GCNLive.com, on RadioLiberty.com, or on RBNLive.com. And all of those carry some of our Internet programs. And then, of course, you can get us 4 hours a day on shortwave. You can get us 9 hours a day on the Telstar satellite. Of course, you're not going to get much accomplished, and some of that's in the middle of the night. But we are up there, and we're hoping, of course, we can get people to pull us down so that they will have access not only to my programs, but to those of Joyce Riley and Chuck Crismeyer and Pastor Judge Putz Palm. We want you to have an opportunity to get the truth that you're not going to get through the controlled media. So if you'd like to help us, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or certainly you can go to our website at www.radioliberty.com, and you can pull down our newsletters and read the various things that we have up there. And of course, you can listen to our programs on the internet. You can, of course, get our programs on MP3. They're at our website at Soundwave 2000 website. Just go to our website. It's well laid out, easy to maneuver around, and you can hear our programs. You can get our newsletters. Remember, we do carry the Berkey products and a few other products. And if you do get the Berkey products to us, well, you'll get a video or 4-tape set that we produced. And then, of course, we want to mention we carry Holly Swanson's excellent book, Set Up and Sold Out. That's Set Up and Sold Out that goes into this whole environmental scam. And it is a scam. You see, the whole idea behind the environmental movement has nothing to do with solving the problems of global warming or certainly, you know, saving the trees and the animals. Or it all has to do with government control. Every problem that they talk about, the solution is a new government program. And that's what it's really all about. And that's why people of great wealth and the oil companies and the great corporations and great foundations and the government have been funding the environmental movement since its inception. And if you haven't read our Peak Oil 2 newsletter, you need to get it because it goes into the background, gives you the documentation of how the oil companies have been funding the environmental movement. Why? Why? Because, of course, the environmental movement has kept the development of nuclear power from taking place. It has actually been used to discourage competition. You can't compete with big oil because they'll turn the environmentalists loose on you, and you try to drill for oil in this country, they'll drop the price and bankrupt you. And that's what it's really all about. That's how it works. So we do hope you want to get Holly Swanson's excellent book, Set Up and Sold Out. We hope you'll want to get our syllabus on sustainable development. And with that, you should get the 4-tape set and or the video. If you get them together, you get a reduced price. That's sustainable development, the video, the 4-tape set and or the syllabus. It has all the documents in it that you need to convince yourself and others that there is an organized effort to markedly decrease our population, to kill off a large part of the world, to impoverish those people who are left, and of course to create a new elite under the control of some very, very powerful people. And so our telephone number, if you'd like to get those items, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or if you haven't seen the video or the audio tape, they're available. You need to get our new video. It's called Planned Population Reduction. They intend to kill off the majority of the people in the world. And you say that couldn't be true. And I would like to ask, why not? After all, if God is just, his justice cannot sleep forever. We ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival. Because if we don't turn back to God, why, we're going to lose America. And please pray for Radio Liberty. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.